This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And I'm delighted to have a brand new guest, someone who I've been intrigued watching their Twitter, and that is Kenneth Raposa. Kenneth, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Peter. Appreciate it.
Oh, great. And people can obviously find you at BrickBreaker is your Twitter handle. And Ken is an industry analyst from the Coalition for a Prosperous America, former staff foreign correspondent for Wall Street Journal, and a senior contributor to Forbes covering China since back in 2011. And there's so many issues we could discuss, but it's that issue of China, which I want to start with. And I've seen a number of your posts, I think on Daily Caller. One of the recent ones was on free trade. I think free traders are wrong. It's time to try trade a new way. And you started off simply by a statement on a Daily Mail poll recently showed 54% of voters support Trump's proposal to put 10% tariffs on imports from China and elsewhere, which is obviously opposite to a free trade thinking. Maybe start there. Why do you think free traders are wrong, and why do you think we need a new model for the future?
Well, the idea of free trade, right, of course, goes back to the British colonial days, right? But in modern times, from our youth and what we recall, it really kicked off in its heyday, we could say, probably post-World War II, and then after the end of the Cold War. It was the end of history, peace in the world, right? No more Soviet Union. We're all on the same page with trade, right? And then it really went into high gear in 2001. This is when China enters the World Trade Organization. And at that point is the beginning of what some people have called hyper-globalization. And that was the Western world's manufacturing base being sucked out of their towns and cities and shipped to Asia. And it has been totally destructive. And it led to the different policies that we have today. You could even say Brexit in some degree was because of it was an anti-globalization vote, you know, because really what's happening is the Western leaders are saying, oh, they know the plebs are against globalization for the most part. And they say, oh, you don't like it anymore. You don't like globalization. Fine. We're going to import all those people that you don't want to compete with in the third world. We're going to import them and we're going to pay them your job, and we're going to pay them your wages that you don't want to accept. We're going to pay them that. And that's the way it's going to go. So it's been a disaster for many people. Brexit is probably one of the examples of an anti-globalist push among the populace. And of course, the Trump election was the creme de la creme of the anti-globalist push within the electorate. So, you know, when you go back to the 80s, 90s, and of course, China joining the World Trade Organization, that's when that was the globalization heyday, and when what many people call a reverse globalization or a localization, or the language is still being defined on this issue. But clearly, the populace of the Western world is against the old school globalization. When I say that, that's 80s, 90s trade, right? The way the model, the way it was. We're going to just import. We're going to make things where it's cheap to make things. And that's how it's going to be. We're a consumer society. We fill our garages not with cars. We fill them with toys and trinkets and all this other stuff instead. And it's going to be made in Mexico and Asia and so on. And if you don't have a job anymore, well, you can learn to code, or you can go drive an Uber, or you can go, maybe if you're lucky, you're good at math, you can go work at Goldman Sachs, so you could become a nurse. I mean, that's it. And people have rejected that. So again, a lot of the people who are pro-free trade, they're guys who are older than us, and they came from the time when free trade was, globalization was becoming a topic, right? Again, the post-Cold War era, and they're thinking they still have that mindset, but there's nothing that shows that free trade has worked for the working class, the blue-collar class. There's been numerous studies showing that it hasn't. It's been great for Walmart. It's been great for multinational corporations, but it hasn't been great for workers. Because why? They have to compete in the West. They have to compete with labor in Mexico, what labor in Vietnam. There's absolutely no way someone in Manchester City, in Newcastle, can make a car, can make a shirt for what they make it in Bangladesh for. There's no way. They can't do it. They'll never, ever do this. So, you know, if you're going to have that kind of world, then you're just going to outsource forever your manufacturing to the to Asia or over here in this hemisphere to Mexico. And I think that's where the backlashes come. And I think that's where free traders really have their blind spot is, okay, it's great. There's always going to be trade. There's always going to be imports. But to what extent are we going to allow this so that your industry, whether it is in London, whether it is in England, whether it is the United States, whether it is in Germany, to what extent are you going to allow it so that you have no blue collar workforce, you have no manufacturing base anymore? To, you know, and that is the question of the day. You know, that is the biggest pushback. We have in the West, we have globalism versus anti-globalism, for lack of a better word, you know, and that's leading to a lot of political stress in the West.
I remember being out on the campaign trail for Brexit with UKIP knocking on doors over the years. And anytime you'd knock on the door of someone who ran a business that was a multinational business, their response would be, I don't want Brexit. I want cheap labor. I want movement of goods and cheap labor as low as possible. That's all I care about. It's the bottom line. And is this a conversation about maybe globalization has not gone the way we expected, that it's purely about the bottom line, then removes the individual from it. Is that kind of the conversation that's beginning to now boil up?
Oh, absolutely. It's beginning to boil up. And again, I think it started with Brexit and it started with Trump. Look what's happening in the world today. Look at Germany, primarily Germany. They're all you see the headlines in The Economist. They're all worried about Chinese EVs coming in. They're all worried in the Netherlands now about Goldwind. Goldwind is the big wind turbine manufacturer that's taking market share away from precious Vestas. Well, that's too bad. But you want to make it all in China. What do you think China's going to do? We're going to say, well, I don't want to make Vestas. I want my own company. I don't want to make Vestas products. I want to be Vestas. Why wouldn't China want that? Why wouldn't they want that? It makes no sense that they wouldn't want that. You know, the UK is a bad example here because the UK used to have Land Rover and used to have, the Mini, right? And now that's all Tata. That's all Indian now.
Yeah.
I don't know who owns Mini, but I mean, certainly Land Rover and Jaguar. These are British, you know, iconic brand, automotive brands. They're owned by Tata Motors in India now. They're probably still made to some degree in the UK, of course, but the brand doesn't belong to the UK anymore. It's Indian. So, they're panicking, and they're panicking because they cannot compete. They will never, ever compete with low-cost labor. They'll never compete with China because China is not interested in the free market competition of the West. They're interested in full employment. And it's a massive nation run by provincial leaders who have different viewpoints of the world than Xi Jinping. If Xi Jinping says, nope, we just talked to Janet Yellen, we just talked to, you know, whatever his name is, the prime minister of the UK, I can't think of it right now. He said that he doesn't want us to overproduce anymore solar panels and wind turbines and EVs. We're going to stop. We got to play by the rules. We could all be friends. Do you think the provincial guy in Nanjing and Guangdong is going to listen to this guy? He's got a million mouths to feed. Millions of people. Millions. More than the UK's entire workforce he has in one province. He's not worried about what Janet Yellen says or what Olaf thinks. To the Chinese, Olaf is a snowman from Frozen. They're not worried about this guy. So, you know, this is something that they can't compete with. And so they're learning now. They're seeing it. And they're worried now. You see them worrying now because their precious renewable energy market is being taken over by China. Well, it's not that China's out innovating them. China just copied what we made here in the West. But China can do it easier because they get the subsidies. They got workers galore. They got workers galore who aren't worried about, you know, TikTok videos and, you know, trying to rehearse for, you know, they want to be the next EDM DJ or they want to get on Eurovision. That's their biggest dream, right? And then these guys are just flooding the market with product. You can't compete with that. You'll never, ever compete with that. But that's the free trade. That's free trade, right? China's saying, hey, you know, We're trading. We're making a product, and the West will say, "Well, yeah, but you're subsidizing, or you're doing this." Well, then the China's going to say, "Well, you subsidize. You subsidize your farmers. The Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, you're giving huge tax breaks to produce. So you're doing it. So you stop. There is no such thing as free trade. There is no such thing as free trade the way people thought it would be. And that doesn't mean that importing is bad or that you and I, Peter and Ken, can't start a business and we can't afford to pay $30 an hour. So we decide on our own volition, we decide to, from the get-go, that we're going to make it in Mexico. We're going to make our widgets in Mexico. That's what we're going to do. That was our plan from the beginning. That's one thing. It's not a thing. It's bad when Ken and Peter were making a widget. We wanted to make it in, you know, Newcastle. We wanted to make it in Portland, Oregon. And now we go, I can't do this anymore. I'm competing with Mexico. I have to close now. You and I, we got to lay off 100 people that we worked with for 10, 20, 30 years. We got to tell them it's over. And these guys are making $30, $40, $50, $60, $70, $80,000 a year. But that's 10 times what the average salary in Mexico, I think, is $16,000. In Vietnam, it's $9,000. So, I mean, it's okay, again, if Ken and Peter decided we're going to make a widget and we were always planning to make it in Mexico because of that wage variable. But then what happens when you and I were making a widget happily here, happily, and now we cannot? Maybe we're done. Maybe you and I are finished. Maybe we're finished. But maybe all the people that we work with every day, they're done. It's all over them. And so that's the free trade world that is being criticized now, because you cannot compete with developing nations on wage alone. Not only that, of course, in the US we have a strong currency. Think about how far my dollar goes in Mexico or China or Vietnam. I could buy a mansion in Vietnam. I could barely buy a trailer in the United States for $300,000. Think about what I could do with that money in Vietnam or Thailand or Mexico, right? So, not only do you have the wage issue, you have a strong currency here because we're such a financial market. All the money from the world comes here. You have, you have higher taxes here than you do in other places. So you're competing on that level too. So there really is the argument of free trade was always a something that was for the textbook, something that the faculty lounge could discuss, an economist could discuss in a dream world, but in reality, it never came to fruition, because it only was good for the big corporations who were transnational. They had no allegiance to a nation. It wasn't Peter and Ken making a widget. It wasn't you and I making bikes in Oregon. Okay. It wasn't that. Okay. It was Walmart buying and selling a million bikes all across the continental United States. We don't care about where we get the bikes. So if I can get it for $100 or $99 and sell it for $110, and I'm selling a million of them, that $1 difference puts $1 million a year in my pocket. It's a big deal. So, I mean, those are the guys who really benefited, but the guy who made the bike doesn't benefit. And for them, it's a huge blow. And I think that is where we are seeing in the West today. That's where the tensions are rising from the electorate. Against the established powers. We can look at even the immigration debate. What is the immigration debate about? It's about, why are we giving these guys all this money? Why these guys are hurting our wages, or these guys are hurting, our ability to get jobs? And so it always relates to that sort of what I call the immigration debate in the West. I call it forced globalism upon the people. Again, like I said earlier in the conversation, it's saying, you don't want us to make a factory in Asia. You don't want us to import goods because you all talk to your elected officials and cry because you want to make steel or whatever here. Good. We're going to import all of them here, and they're going to make it for half your pay. Or we're going to totally stunt your wage growth forever. So that is always the stem of the issue in the West. It's always this rush to globalization, creating this, where planet Earth is the nation state rather than the UK is a nation and Germany is a nation or the EU is a bloc. No. There's districts like Hunger Games. This is the district that makes this widget. This is the district that makes that widget. And then free capital moves throughout the world. And that's a dream of the free trader. But that's not a dream of the person, again, Ken and Pete, who, were making a widget. And now we cannot do that anymore because we cannot compete with Mexico. There is no way in hell we're going to do it. We're not going to make it for the same price you can make it in Albania, for crying out loud. It's all over. And so something's got to give. And there's a lot of politicians that realize that. And there's a lot who are pushing back, obviously.
Well, we've in that article you talk about some of the old understanding of the views on globalization are changing. So you talk about trade deficits don't matter, or imports don't take American jobs. I mean, those are two issues which will come home to roost for individuals, because the US, massive trade gap, that has a cost. And of course, if you're all getting your stuff from Temu, then actually no one needs to actually work in America to produce anything. So where are the jobs? And is it a waking up to the damage that that unrestricted, uncontrolled mass globalization causes in those two simple things of trade deficit and simple jobs?
Well, yeah, there is a waking up. Look, I look back, you know, I'm not an old guy, so I remember in the 90s, I was young, I was probably just starting to vote, when a man named Ross Perot was talking about this, what it would be like when the United States created the free trade area of North America, right, NAFTA. And he said it would be a huge sucking sound of American jobs going to Mexico. And at the time, remember, Mexico was a country that was in and out of default. It was survived on the IMF. It was like Argentina. It was basically Argentina of North America. And of course, NAFTA saved it. NAFTA saved it, but it became essentially to the United States, the 51st state. And what's happening now? Let's talk about the free trade agreement of North America. Let's talk about NAFTA for a second. That idea was always to, Mexico's our neighbor. They're always in and out of a financial crisis or an economic crisis. Let's help them with trade. Let's help them do this. And it was a success to a large extent, right? I mean, it's still way poorer than we are here in the US and Canada, way poorer. You can't even compare the wages between the two countries. It's just, you know, at least three times more here. But companies from around the world are going to Mexico now. So Germany is setting up shop to make electric vehicles there. Of course, Korea and Hyundai make cars there, but a lot of those cars are for sale in Mexico. Those are big sellers in Mexico. But I highly doubt that the BMW electric vehicle is a high-powered vehicle, selling vehicle in Mexico. I don't think that's the market. That is going to come here. The Japanese are making steel in Mexico. That is coming here. That is coming here duty-free. So now NAFTA has become a free trade zone for any multinational that wants to set up shop in Mexico. It's not, I mean, it's helping the Mexicans and the locals and the Mexican workers, but it's really a multinational free trade zone. If you can set up shop in Mexico and, of course, employ Mexicans and so on and pay Mexican taxes, you can sell your goods where? Well, to the biggest consumer economy in the world, right? You're going to sell them here. You're not setting up to sell there. I mean, Mexico, tiny. Your next door neighbor's right here. I mean, so, you know, this is a problem, but that's the free trade. That's the free trade topic. That's the free trade model. And people do not like it. Clearly, they do not like it. It doesn't mean they don't like free trade. Obviously, we want to trade. Again, you and I have a factory. We make a widget. We want to trade with the world, right? We do want to trade with the world. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, if people perceive from the UK, from Germany, from the United States, they perceive that their leaders were obsessed, that's changing, with this globalization model of one world kumbaya, right? Everything's going to be made in Asia. Everything's going to be made in Mexico. And they cannot survive. They cannot survive on that. And so either you're going to have a city and town that's just, you know, where you have marijuana shops and treatment centers, and that's going to be your new industry and casinos, or you're going to have a place where people can survive making things like kitchen cabinets or furniture. And if you don't want that, then okay, then admit you don't want that. And what are you going to do to replace it? Okay, then what do they say? Well, we're going to have universal basic income. So they know they do come up with solutions, but that's their solution. That's their solution. So I'm not convinced that people are on board with that for the most part. Right? I don't know. Maybe there are some lazy people who are fine with universal basic income. I'm sure there are people who would be fine with that, but. You know, people are against this model of this globalization model, and it's being turned on its head in the West, and it is a source of a lot of political problems. And of course, China is, you know, the 10,000-pound gorilla, however that saying goes, in the room, and everybody sees that now. It was Trump really that made people see that, but Europe's seeing it now as well. So where that leads in the years ahead, I don't know, but you know, people clearly do not like the setup the way it was pre-Trump, let's say, pre-Brexit, where the goal was, hey, we're just going to make everything in China. We're going to make everything in Asia, and that's it. And you can again, you can learn to become a new EDM DJ and, you know, train for Eurovision, and maybe you'll get lucky. And that's the extent of it.
Well, we've got UBI coming in Wales as a test bed, but that's a whole other conversation. With Wales have found how you get free money, which is a change in how humanity works. But I want to ask, you did another post looking at, I think the title was US Risks Losing Its Status as an Exemplar of a Free Country with Laws. And you talked about China's soft power slowly winning hearts and minds, see it in developing countries, in other countries it's not. But there does seem to be that move from that kind of American dream. Everyone wants to come to America to see the sights, the sounds, to see the miracle that is America. That seems to now be moving towards China with a huge focus on it. So what are your thoughts? Tell us more about that, about the U.S. losing that position, having its soft power of influence worldwide.
Okay, well, for starters, you know, America is still seen as a place in Europe as well, as a place where people from developing countries want to go, right? If we were seen as a failing society and failing countries, I would assume people from other failing countries wouldn't want to come here. But I don't know how informed these people are about what it looks like today in the streets of San Francisco, how much it costs to live in New York City. They might still believe that, you know, California is paved with gold and they can become, Hollywood actors in a year or two, you know, singing and dancing on the streets of Hollywood and Vine. Maybe they believe that. They're in for a rude awakening, but that sort of vision of the United States may still exist in parts of Latin America. I believe that is eroding. Okay. Now, on the China side, with soft power, of course, you know, so soft power is defined as, you know, diplomacy, but it's also defined as culture, right? And it's also defined as corporate branding, right? So culture, United States wins hands down, right? Everybody knows Hollywood, right? American music. We got Taylor Swift. China doesn't have the Chinese Taylor Swift, you know? So we have, you know, The Rock and so on, right? We have all these movies. That's an immeasurable positive for the United States culturally. But in terms of diplomacy and just soft power in general, let's look at what happened recently. So you have Russia's war with Ukraine. So obviously Russia is part of the big four emerging markets. It's part of the BRIC collective. And, you know, these guys have been, these leaders of these countries have been talking and developing relationships for at least, I would say 20 years now. Okay. When the West asked all these countries to support them in their view on Russia, not to a man, none of them went along with it. Sure. None of them. Okay. This is completely different than what it was like in the 80s. If you tell like Brazil, hey, we need you to send some weapons to Ukraine, Brazil couldn't say no, because the United States said, well, we're going to hold back that IMF loan. We're going to hold back that development loan for that bridge you're trying to build, that dam you want. But either you start putting out, you know, make it look like you're on our side and start churning out some ammo for the Ukrainians, or the money for that hydroelectric dam, it's off the table. That's not a thing anymore. The United States has lost that. So when you see countries in the developing world that can say no to the West, say no to to Europe and the United States, right, and ignore them, that is a sign that the soft power of the West is eroding. I'm not saying that's eroding in favor of China, okay, but it's eroding in sense of there's a sense of, you know, imbalance in the world, right? There's a sense of that people in the developing world, the leaders in the developing world are saying, we don't want, you know, the unipolar view anymore, right? Let's go more of a multipolar view, right? Maybe that doesn't mean China's in the lead. We don't know who the multipolar is going to be. We don't know. But there is a pushback against the United States way. And I don't know. I think there was a real severing of that with COVID. Honestly, because, you know, everybody in the world saw, you know, how the West treated its people during COVID. I mean, we saw what China did, right? Locking people in apartments in Wuhan and so on. We saw those things, saw that. And who knows, Mac, that could have, for all we know here in the West, that could have been just orchestrated to make it look to us in the West that this disease is so bad. Look what the Chinese are doing. They have to literally lock people in their homes or they'll die. this is how bad it is. So that could have been a psyop in a way, for all I know.
Sure.
But you had people in Canada losing their bank accounts, right? You had people in the United States being arrested for protesting lockdowns. You had people vilified for it and so on. While Black Lives Matter and Antifa were able to parade around. Of course, they had their sciency masks on, so I guess that was all good. And, you know, breaking things and knocking statues down and whatever, and they were fine. So that 6 feet distance didn't matter to them. And people, you know, look, people around the world see that, right? People, I mean, I remember even the president of Mexico said, Obrador, he said, you know, COVID showed the Western world authoritarianism. He showed that the Western world could be authoritarian, just like, you know, what they always criticize us as being, you know. I mean, this is fascinating. This is not a language that you would hear Mexico ever say about the United States. You'd be instantly punished. What does Mexico do to the United States to help us police the border? What does Mexico do for the United States to help us stop fentanyl? Do you ever hear about them beating up on Sinaloa or Jalisco? I mean, unless like the DEA is involved, those guys just run around free like you and I, you know, going and getting a sandwich in a local shop. I mean, there's nothing to do. There's nothing happening there to fight it, right? So, you know, these, and I think I look at that as being a sign. That is a sign that the West really is no longer the exemplar on a lot of the issues that it was on issues like democracy, where all this talk about misinformation and control, that there is sort of a severing of ties, if you will, from the developing world with the West. And I'm not saying that China is going to replace it. We don't want that. But I'm also of the mind that there are many people in the West who really like the China model, and they wouldn't even complain if the China model replaced ours, because they love the top-down societal, you know, government control aspects of the CCP. And many of them think in the West that they could just wrap it in the pretty bows of, you know, diversity, inclusion, and environmental justice, and all the urban educated classes will say, "Oh, that sounds reasonable. That sounds like a good way to go." So, you know, within the eyes of the developing world, right, it's very difficult for me to say that they are all going to agree with the U.S. on certain things. That wasn't the case when we were kids. It was not. America was always the right, always in the right, always. Now it's like, you know, they might not agree. They're not going to go along with it, you know. Go ahead.
No, you've seen in Africa, especially China using their financial muscle to go in to start massive infrastructure projects, part of the Belt and Braces. And America seems to be very much hands off. And it seems to be, as the West is maybe moved away from parts of Africa, China has gone into that vacuum and imposed itself and now is building infrastructure across the continent, and the West then scratch your heads and wonder why they have less power. Well, it's because you've handed that industrial, that financial power over to China, and they are now the ones that rule because of those tight contracts. But they're the ones that get people from A to B by building a road or building a railway. So they're the ones that Africa need, and no longer the West.
Yeah, and you know, where did they come up with this idea? This was what the West did. This is what the United States did in the post World War II, right? The United States went to the world and said, "We're going to help rebuild. We're going to get you modernized. That was soft power. We're going to get you on our side. We're going to get you to see things our way. We're going to get you to be our political and economic partner." And so we don't really see that as much anymore. I don't really know why. Maybe it is like a late empire type situation, right? Where we're worried more about silly things, cultural issues, right? That the other part of the world doesn't worry about. I mean, I think that was something famously said by someone in Africa. They said, "Look, China comes here giving us money to build roads and bridges. And when you guys come here, you give us lectures on gender, you know, or climate change," right? But that's not to say the Africans don't want American business and don't want I'm sure they do. But that's not in a lot of ways, that's not what the United States is in there for. And I think only recently the United States has realized, they've seen the error of their ways, because, you know, I get to sit in on a lot of these hearings in Congress. And I know that they want to counter China in that way. Right. So everything but it's a knee-jerk react to China. It's not necessarily a long-term planning thing. So, okay, well, how do we go to this country and, you know, propose this. So what else can we do? Everything is a knee jerk. And that is a problem. But at least they see that they've been caught on the back foot over the last few years, whereas China has, in terms of soft power, diplomacy, right, getting their corporate brands all over the world, right, and they see now, wow, we're losing a lot of that. I mean, think about it. I remember being my first time going to Latin America in the 90s, and I'm sure this was the case in the 80s and the 70s. I mean, Ford, McDonald's, Hollywood, those were symbols. Those are like the unpaid American ambassadors, right? And so look today. I mean, you can probably count on one hand, unless you drive a German car, how many German item products you have in your house, you know? I have a Miele vacuum cleaner. I think that's German, you know? But for the most part, you know, your kid has TikTok on their phone. You might have a Lenovo computer or a Lexmark printer in your office. You know, there's a lot of Chinese corporate brands that are very well known. Your kid probably buys clothes on Shein or you probably shop on Temu, right? So these are, what's the European equivalent to that? I don't know of any. I can't name one big European app. Honestly, I just can't. And even e-commerce, I can't think of a single one. So this is China. So this is the soft power. These are very important issues for the United States that used to dominate that, for example, in Latin America. And now they do not. They do not dominate that at all. It's China that is moving in. China's moving in the auto industry. China is moving in big retail and in some areas, even finance. So, you know, I think that's an interesting look to see. Like, what's it going to be like in another generation? You know, China may be seen as a better partner. And as I mentioned in Daily Caller, there was a survey by the Singaporean think tank run by the government that showed a small amount. I think it was 50.4%. So it's almost 50-50 of government leaders, right? Not just men on the street, who said strategically they felt it was better to, you know, the dial was moving a little bit more towards China than the United States, you know. Even the fact that it's 50-50 should be worrying to, you know, the U.S., right? I mean, I'm speaking as an American here, right? It should be worrying that it's even 50-50, but it is. And, you know, so that goes to show the power of China, you know, not just not militarily and all this stuff, but just doing business with China and then seeing things China's way in many degrees.
Well, it's true. Then that report, Singapore report of the Southeast, it makes you realize that China doesn't actually need to use its military power, because obviously it is ramping up its military spending, wanting to actually impose itself on the South China Sea, make sure America is not there. And actually, in one way, it needs to do that, because I guess you've got Taiwan and Japan maybe as entities that are not pro-China. But everywhere else, in one way, trade is actually making, building bridges with those countries. So there's actually less reason for China to spend all that huge amount of money on military power whenever soft power through trade and commerce, that's actually winning over Southeast Asia.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They're more connected to Asia, more connected to China because of commerce, right? A lot of Chinese multinationals especially have been setting up shop in Southeast Asia to make everything from LED light bulbs to furniture and so on. Solar panels are huge in Vietnam and Malaysia. Chinese multinationals are all there, and they're selling it all over the world, right? Mostly the United States and Europe. But again, China does want to build up its military because they see, and this is one thing I think the military worries about, is they see this. They think, you know, the military is a good place for me to have I have an industrial base. The military is a good place for me to make big products, big expensive items, like a drone. Drones are a big thing now. Autonomous ships, autonomous aircraft. Sure. China's big on that. I don't know if Russia makes those. So who is the United States competing with a lot of times for like military contracts with in Asia? Russia. So India might buy, or Saudi Arabia. So India might buy an F-15, but it might also buy a Sukhoi.
Yeah.
Might buy both. Might buy a MiG. Might buy, an F-15. But now China's saying, hey, wait a minute. Why don't I also let them buy, I don't know anything about China fighting, but a China fighting tiger.
Hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, the Vietnamese don't just have F-15s. They got a Chinese fighting tiger too. Okay. So it's very important for China to move into military, not because they want to protect the South China Sea and get the U.S. military out of there, get that U.S. military protectorate agreement out of Asia, because China sees this is my backyard, not yours. And they're going to muscle in and give options. But also, and thinking of military as a product, I have autonomous boats. Hey, Vietnam, you want to police that? You want to have a Coast Guard? You want to police illegal fishing? You want whatever? You want to police drugs in the Malaga Straits without getting your soldiers injured? I got autonomous boats. America makes autonomous boats, but we're even better at it. And that's a big deal. That's a huge deal. People don't realize. All of a sudden, who's competing with the United States? Who's competing with Lockheed Martin to make an autonomous boat? The Chinese. That it's, look, when you think of flying internationally, there's only two airlines, there's only two planes you've ever been on. You've been on a Boeing and you've been on an Airbus. But now China, I only know the abbreviation of the company, it's called COMAC, has the C, I think it's called the C919.
Yeah.
And that's an international wide body jet that's going to take you from Shanghai to Paris. Well, guess what? So one day, when that plane is seen as doing, you know, maybe, you know, in terms of safety record is solid and whatever, the airlines are going to buy that, going to buy a COMAC instead of an Airbus, instead of a Boeing. And guess what else is even more interesting? Do you think that the Chinese are going to subsidize a Boeing jet or an Airbus plane? No, they're going to subsidize COMAC so COMAC can become the Vietnamese airline of choice. Carrier that, you know, maybe not Japan, because the United States would muscle in there, I'm sure. Maybe even France would too. Maybe even in Vietnam, in the case of France and Vietnam. But other areas like Kazakhstan, Russia, for example, Aeroflot would probably be all right. I don't even envision a future of Aeroflot in Russia using Airbus and Boeing. I don't even see why they would want to. If that COMAC jet is safe. Well, you know, Boeing planes, their doors fall off in mid-flight lately, right? So if the COMAC is safe, why would Russia want to buy an American or a French plane? The Americans and the French hate them.
Yeah. I agree. I'm a plane buff, and I think I would rather fly in a Chinese aircraft than a Boeing at the moment. So, the aircraft could be better. I just want to finish on a. Other issue on, I think one of your tweets was, the established powers of the West love the CCP model of social control and governance. And you made, they're wrapping it up in this diversity. But this whole thing on the control that China have on their citizens, and obviously during COVID, the West suddenly thought, oh, we can now use this to actually control our citizens. And then in the UK, you realize that a lot of our CCTV systems on the streets, and a lot of the CCTV systems used in shops are actually Chinese systems. So who knows where the data goes. But it's interesting how the West, looking at China, once again, it's China that will provide the infrastructure and the setup for the West. So the West kind of look at that and think, we'd like some of that control. And China, again, are the world leaders. And once again, they provide what the West wants to control the citizens.
Yeah, they're sort of like a petri dish in a way, yep. Right? The Chinese people of what the West would like. Now, the Western world, because you live in democracies where people still have a say, but that's changing. Yep. Because they can vilify in the West and use the media and say that people like Peter, who think that this way, they're conspiracy theorists, they're right wingers, they're fascists, whatever it is, they're transphobic, they don't believe in science, you know, the whole nine yards, the usual things, right? That's how they get the other half of society to sort of bludgeon you. So the government doesn't have to do anything, right? The other half of polite society can say, oh, that Peter guy, you know, has a weird views of things. What's wrong with surveillance? We're not doing anything bad. So what, you know? Look, I'm of the mind that in the West, because we are a democracy and people still have a say, they have to divide the people in a way that When you are opposed to the regime, when you're opposed to the government, you're going to be a person who's spreading misinformation. You're going to be someone who needs to be censored. You're going to be someone who needs to be punished. And so that is the way that they're able to corral people, right, who don't want to be punished, don't want to be censored, don't want to be vilified, and they can be on this on team regime. They could be on the side of the power. So if you were looking at China, you could be on the side of the CCP. Why would the why would an average Chinese person want to go against the CCP? You see what happens, right? You see what happens. So in the US and in Europe, you're doing that with different laws like misinformation law. You're trying to shut down that debate, trying to shut down people, allowing people to talk about certain things so you can vilify them or you can just end it at all. But at least, at the very least, vilify these people so that the other half of society, whether it's a third or whether it's a half, I don't know, can say, yeah, you know, those people deserve to be punished, or those people deserve to be ostracized from society. And that gives, of course, the government more control, right? Because they can't control, they can't just come out and say, we're going to do this, we're going to, you know, give you digital currency and program what you can buy or whatever. That's not going to happen. That can to some extent happen in China, but it'd be very hard to do that in the West. But, you know, I'm of the mind that they won't succeed at this. I hope not. I could be wrong. I don't want, you can talk about this for hours, right? You almost need a theologian to talk about some of these issues. Because I think that people, because of all these alternative media people like yourself, Peter, right? They've come out and they're almost ahead, right? That we're one step ahead of you know, how the powers that be think, or at least we understand how they think. We can analyze it and we can come out and say, this is what they could do. Maybe we're wrong. But if we're right, then it's almost like these guys can't do it. You know what I mean? Because now it's like, now they're going to say, well, I know we said we weren't going to do it. We did it, but it is a good idea because. And then when you keep having to do that, what happens? What's happening in the West? You delegitimize the system. You delegitimize the institution because of that gaslighting. Because you said you weren't going to do this. The guys you said were spreading misinformation said you were going to do it. You did do it. And then you said, yeah, but it's good that we did it. Yeah, you can't keep doing that in society. But that's the way that the West moves to a China control like model, because they just can't do it, right? We don't live in a dictatorship. You can't just do it. But that's the way that they move you in that direction. But as long as people like yourself and others in media, and of course, you have a big star in the UK, Russell Brand, he's huge. He's big here in the United States. As long as they're up ahead of that, then I think it becomes harder because more people are aware, more people are curious about how the powers are trying to control things in their life, you know, and then it's less likely that they will succeed. You know, it is less likely they succeed when more people are aware of what's at stake and more people are aware of what the planning is or how their thinking is. As long as we think that, as long as we want to be free people and don't live like the CCP runs China, then we know that the guys who are perfectly fine with us living like the CCP, if we can be out ahead of them, then we can stop it, because they don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want to look like fools. But of course, you know, in the worst case scenario, they will get more aggressive, more vicious, and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And I think that's, unfortunately, that's the place we find ourselves now in Europe, in the UK, the United States, and Canada. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next few years.
It will be, and we'll see how November changes things, because we've little pushback in Europe. So I think the US have a chance of some pushback in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did have a big pushback with that farmer protest. That was pretty serious, I think. I think that farmer protest was really eye-opening, you know, for a lot of people. I mean, I think, didn't it disrupt some government in the Netherlands or Denmark? I forget, but somebody was overthrown, or a political party that was in...
It overthrew the government of the Netherlands in effect, and yeah. Has not. The issue is actually when you protest, you have media, you highlight it, then you're looking for a political solution to come in on the back of that, and Europe haven't yet got that. Now, the European Union elections will be interesting coming up in only months, and that could change things. But whether the EU are able to remove themselves from China's pocket is a big question, just like it is from the state side, whether you guys can remove yourself from that. And China have done well on, I guess, embedding themselves into all our institutions.
Look, in Europe, I think the issue with the renewable energy side that they're talking about now, and China really dominating that market, that might see them split a little bit with China. So that'll be interesting to watch, to see how the Europeans, which promote climate change, want renewable, want a post-fossil fuel economy, and then go, oh, wait a minute now, we want a post-fossil fuel economy, but we literally have nothing to make a post-fossil fuel economy. Yeah, we have EVs, but we don't have an EV battery maker. Yeah, we have wind, but we have no solar to speak of. If we do it, small little companies, they're all dominated by the Chinese. They're just too, it's like Peter and Ken's, you know, solar manufacturing plant. We employ 1,000 people and we have like, you know, a few rooftops in southern Spain have our product, but we're not big players. No one's afraid of us. You know, we're happily employing a few people and making some money and until the Chinese come in and buy us out, whatever. But, you know, they don't have the infrastructure for that. So I think I'd be curious to see how Europe reacts to China within the renewable energy space. And I see that as being where China really becomes, well, Europe really splinters off from China because they're not going to be able to compete with China in that market. And they consider that to be, obviously, Europe, all they talk about is climate change. They consider that to be probably their most important market in the future.
Yeah, 100%. More solar panels from China will solve everything.
The temperature will fall at least 1 degree in the next 20 years.
It will. Kenneth, I really appreciate you coming on. I've loved following your Twitter and obviously your many articles on Daily Caller. People can get in the description if they're watching, if they're listening. It's there as well now, the podcast platform. So thank you so much for joining us and giving us your thoughts on China.
Thanks for having me on, Peter. Appreciate it.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.